would be reversed. Stacy Mall said, "Okay, here's Mike Taxiway." She turned the Piper right onto the narrow asphalt strip. A number of the hangar doors were open, and Khalil noticed many types of aircraft, small, single-engine aircraft such as he was in, strange aircraft with one wing above another, and medium-sized jet aircraft. He asked, "Do these aircraft have any military purpose?" She laughed. "No, these are boys' toys. Understand? I fly to make a living. Most of these clowns fly just to give themselves something to do or to impress their friends. Hey, I'm going to school for jet training. Big bucks, but some guy's paying for it. Wants me to be his corporate jet pilot. You know? Some of the big shots want military guys, like I said, but some of them want, like, a toy inside the toy. Get it? Excuse me? Where are you from? Greece. Yeah? I thought the Greek millionaires... Anyway, here we are. Yankee Taxiway." She veered to the right, and the taxiway ended at a concrete apron attached to a large hangar. On the hangar wall was a small sign that said, "Paul Gray." The hangar was open, revealing a twin-engine aircraft, a Mercedes-Benz convertible, a staircase that led to a loft, and a golf cart. She said, "This guy has all the toys. That's a Beach Bear and a Model 58, and it looks pretty new. Big buckaroos. You selling him something?" "Yes, the vases." "Yeah? They expensive?" "Very." "Good. He's got the dough. The money." "Hey, is this guy married?" "No, he is not." "Ask him if he needs a co-pilot." She laughed. She shut down the Piper's engine. "You've got to get out first, unless you want me crawling over your lap." She laughed. "Just take it nice and easy. I'll hold your bag." She took the bag off his lap. He exited the aircraft onto the skid-proof section of the wing. She handed the bag to him, and he placed it on the wing. Khalil stepped off the aft end of the Piper's wing and dropped onto the concrete. He turned and retrieved his bag from the wing. Stacy followed him and jumped off the low wing onto the concrete, but lost her balance and found herself stumbling forward into her passenger. "Whoops." She bumped into Khalil and held his shoulder to steady herself. The sunglasses slipped off, and aside Khalil stood less than 6 inches from Stacy Mall, face to face. She looked into his eyes, and he stared back at her. Finally, she smiled and said, "Sorry." Khalil stooped down, retrieved his sunglasses, and put them on. She took her cigarettes out of her pocket and lit one. She said, "I'll wait here in the hangar where it's shady. I'm going to help myself to something to drink in his refrigerator and use a bathroom in the hangar. They all have toilets and refrigerators, sometimes kitchens and offices. So when the missus kicks their butts out, they don't have far to go." She laughed. "Tell this guy I'm taking a Coke. I'll leave a buck." "Yes." She said, "Hey, Mr. Wonderful is a short walk from here. Maybe I should go say hello." "Perhaps you should stay here." He added, "This should not take long." "Yeah, just kidding. I'd probably put a crimp in his fuel line if he wasn't around." Khalil turned toward the concrete footpath that led toward the house. She called out, "Good luck. Squeeze him hard. Make him pay in blood." Khalil looked over his shoulder. "Excuse me?" "Means make him pay a lot." "Yes. I will make him pay in blood." He followed the path through some shrubbery until it came to a screen door that led to a large screened-in pool. He tried the door, and it was open. He entered the pool area, noting the lounge chairs, a small serving counter, and a flotation device in the pool. There was another door, and he stepped up to it. Inside, he could see a large kitchen area. He looked at his watch and saw that it was 9:10. He pushed the doorbell button and waited. Birds sang in the nearby trees, some sort of creature made a croaking sound, and a small aircraft circled overhead. After a full minute, a man dressed in tan pants and a blue shirt came to the door and looked at him through the glass. Khalil smiled. The man opened the door and said, Colonel Herrick?
Yes, Captain Gray.
Yes, sir. Just Mr. Gray. Call me Paul. Come on in.
Asad Khalil entered the large kitchen of Mr. Paul Gray. The house was air-conditioned, but not uncomfortably cold. Paul Gray said,
Can I take that bag?
No need. Paul Gray glanced at his wall clock and said,
You're a little early, but no problem. I'm all set.
Good. How did you get to the house?
I instructed my pilot to use the taxiways.
Oh, how did you know what taxiways to use?
Mr. Gray, there is little that my organization does not know about you. That is why I am here. You have been chosen.
Okay. Sounds good to me. How about a beer?
Just bottled water, please.
Khalil watched Paul Gray as he retrieved a container of juice and a plastic bottle of mineral water from the refrigerator, then went to the cupboard for two glasses. Paul Gray was not tall, but he seemed to be in excellent physical condition. His skin was as brown as a Berber's, and like General Wycliffe, his hair was gray, but his face was not old. Paul Gray asked,
Where's your pilot?
She is sheltering from the sun in your hangar. She asked if it was permissible to use your toilet there and to have something to drink.
Sure, no problem. You got a lady pilot?
Yes.
Maybe she wants to come in and look at this demonstration. It's awesome.
No. As I said, we must be discreet.
Of course. Sorry.
Khalil added, I told her I was a Greek selling you antique Greek vases. He hefted his black bag and smiled.
Paul Gray smiled back and said, Good cover. I guess you could be Greek.
Why not?
Gray handed Khalil a glass of mineral water. Khalil said, No glass. He explained, I am kosher. No offense, but I cannot use non-kosher items.
Sorry.
Not a problem.
Gray retrieved another plastic bottle of mineral water and gave it to his guest. Khalil took it and said, Also, I have a condition of my eyes and must wear these dark glasses. Gray held up his glass of orange juice and said,
Welcome, Colonel Herrick.
They touched glass to bottle and drank. Gray said,
Well, come on into my war room, Colonel, and we can get started.
Khalil followed Paul Gray through the rambling house. Khalil commented,
A very beautiful home.
Thank you. I was lucky enough to buy during a slight downturn in the market. I only had to pay twice what it was worth.
Gray laughed. They entered a large room, and Paul Gray slid the pocket door closed behind them.
No one will disturb us.
There is someone in the house?
Only the cleaning lady. She won't bother us in here.
Khalil looked around the large room, which seemed to be a combination of a sitting room and an office. Everything appeared to be expensive. The plush carpet, the wood furniture, the electronics against the far wall. He saw four computer screens with keyboards and other controls in front of each screen.
Paul Gray said, Let me take that bag for you.
Khalil said, I'll put this down with my water.
Paul Gray indicated a low coffee table on which was a newspaper. Gray and Khalil put their drinks down on the table, and Khalil placed his bag on the floor, then said,
Do you mind if I look around the room?
Not at all.
Khalil moved to a wall on which hung photographs and paintings of many different aircraft, including a realistic painting of an F-111 fighter jet, which Khalil studied.
Paul Gray said, I had that done from a photograph. I flew F-111s for a lot of years.
Yes, I know that.
Paul Gray didn't reply. Khalil studied a wall that displayed many citations, letters of commendation, and a framed, glass-enclosed case in which 9 military medals were mounted.
Gray said, I received many of those medals for my part in the Gulf War, but I guess you know that too.
Yes. and my government appreciates your service on our behalf.
Khalil walked to a shelf unit that held books and plastic models of various aircraft. Paul Gray came up behind him and took a book off the shelf.
Here, you'll appreciate this one. It was written by General Gideon Shaudar. He signed it for me.
Khalil took the book, which had a fighter aircraft on the cover, and saw that it was in Hebrew.
Paul Gray said, "Look at the inscription."
Asad Khalil opened the book to the back, which, as he knew, was the beginning of the book in Hebrew, as it was in Arabic, and saw that the inscription was in English, but there were also Hebrew characters which he could not read.
Paul Gray said, "Finally, someone who can translate the Hebrew for me."
Asad Khalil stared at the Hebrew writing and said, "It is actually an Arabic proverb which we Israelis are also fond of. He who is the enemy of my enemy is my friend."
Khalil handed the book back to Gray and remarked, "Very appropriate."
Paul Gray shelved the book and said, "Let's sit a minute before we start." He motioned Khalil to an upholstered chair beside the coffee table. Khalil sat, and Paul Gray sat opposite him. Paul Gray sipped on his orange juice. Khalil drank from his bottle of water.
Gray said, "Please understand, Colonel, that the software demonstration I'm going to show you could be considered classified material. But as I understand it, I can show it to a representative of a friendly government. But when it comes to the question of purchasing it, then we have to get clearance."
"I understand that. My people are already working on that." He added, "I appreciate the security. We would not want this software to fall into the hands of, let's say, our mutual enemies."
He smiled.
Paul Gray returned the smile and said, "If you mean certain Mideastern nations, I doubt they'd be able to put this to any practical use. To be honest with you, Colonel, those people don't have the brains they were born with."
Khalil smiled again and said, "Never underestimate an enemy."
"I try not to, but if you'd been in my cockpit in the Gulf, you'd think you were flying against a bunch of crop dusters." He added, "That doesn't bring much credit on me, but I'm talking to a pro, so I'll be honest."
Khalil replied, "As my colleagues told you, though I am the embassy air attaché officer, I'm afraid I have no combat experience in attack aircraft. My area of expertise is training and operations, so I cannot regale you with any heroic war stories."
Gray nodded.
Khalil regarded his host for a moment. He could have killed him the moment he opened the kitchen door, or any time since then. But the killing would be almost meaningless without some pleasant trifling. Malik had said to him, "All members of the cat family toy with their captured prey before killing them. Take your time. Savor the moment. It will not come again."
Khalil nodded toward the newspaper on the coffee table and said, "You've read what has been revealed about Flight 175?
Gray glanced down at the newspaper.
"Yes, some heads are going to roll over that. I mean, how the hell did those Libyan clowns pull that off? A bomb on board is one thing, but gas? And then the guy escapes and kills a bunch of federal agents. I see the hand of Muammar Gaddafi in this."
"Yes, perhaps. It's unfortunate that the bomb you dropped on his residence at Al-Aziziyah didn't kill him."
Paul Gray did not reply for a few seconds, then said, "I had no part in that mission, Colonel, and if your intelligence service thinks I did, they're wrong."
Asad Khalil waved his hand in a placating gesture.
"No, no, Captain. I did not mean you personally. I meant the American Air Force."
"Oh, sorry."
"However," Khalil continued, "if you were on that mission, then I congratulate you and thank you on behalf of the Israeli people."
Paul Gray remained expressionless, then stood and said, "Why don't we move over here and have a look?"
Khalil stood, took his bag, and followed Paul Gray to the far side of the room where two leather swivel chairs sat facing two screens. Paul Gray said, "First, I'll show you a demonstration of the software just using this joystick and the keyboard. Next, we'll move to those other two chairs where we'll enter the world of virtual reality." He moved to the two more elaborate chairs with no TV screens in front of them. He said, "Here we use computer modeling and simulation to enable a person to interact with an artificial, three-dimensional, visual, and other sensory environments. Are you familiar with this?" Khalil did not reply. Paul Gray hesitated a moment, then continued, "Virtual reality applications immerse the user in a computer-generated environment that simulates reality through the use of interactive devices which send and receive information. These devices are typically goggles, helmets, gloves, or even bodysuits. Here I have two helmets with a stereoscopic screen for each eye where you can view animated images of a simulated environment. The illusion of being there, telepresence, is affected by motion sensors that pick up the user's movements and adjust the view on the screens accordingly, usually in real time." Paul Gray looked at his potential customer, but could see no sign of comprehension or non-comprehension behind the sunglasses. Paul Gray continued, "Here you see I've set up a generic fighter-bomber cockpit, complete with rudder pedals, throttles, control stick, bomb release triggers, and so forth. Since you have no experience with fighter craft, you won't be able to fly this thing, but you can experience a bomb run just by putting on the stereoscopic helmet while I fly." Asad Khalil looked at the elaborate paraphernalia around him, then said, "Yes, we have similar capabilities in our Air Force." "I know you do, but the software that has recently been developed is years ahead of existing software. Let's sit in front of the monitors, and I'll give you a quick look before we move on to virtual reality." They moved back to the other side of the room, and Paul Gray indicated one of the two leather swivel chairs with a console between them and a keyboard in front of each chair. Khalil sat. Paul Gray, still standing, said, "These are seats from an old F-111 that I put swivel legs on, just to get us in the spirit." "Not very comfortable." "No, they're not. I've flown long distances in those seats." "Can I hang your jacket?" "No, thank you. I am not accustomed to the air conditioning." "You may want to take your sunglasses off when I dim the room." "Yes." Paul Gray sat in the aircraft seat beside Khalil and picked up a remote control from the console, hit two buttons, and the lights dimmed as heavy blackout curtains drew closed over the large windows. Khalil removed his sunglasses. They sat silently in the darkness for a second, watching the lights of the electronics around them. The image screen brightened and showed the cockpit and windshield of an advanced jet attack fighter. Paul Gray said, "This is the cockpit of the F-16, but several other aircraft can be used in this simulation. You have some of these aircraft in your armory. The first simulation that I'll show you is of an aerial toss-bombing mission. Fighter pilots who spend 10 or 15 hours with this relatively inexpensive software are that many hours ahead of a pilot who goes cold into a flight training program. This can save millions of dollars per pilot." The view through the windshield of the simulated cockpit suddenly changed from blue sky to a green horizon. Paul Gray said, "Now I'm just using this joystick with a few additional controls and the keyboard, but the software can be interfaced with the actual controls of most modern American attack aircraft, which are placed in a virtual reality ground simulator, which we'll see later."
"This is very interesting,"
Paul Gray said. "Now, the targets programmed into the software are mostly imaginary targets, generic stuff. Bridges, airfields, anti-aircraft emplacements, and missile sites. They shoot back at you." He laughed and continued, "But I have some real targets pre-programmed in, plus other real targets can be programmed if there's some aerial recon or satellite shots of it."
"I understand."
"Good. Let's take out a bridge." The view through the computer-generated windshield changed from a featureless horizon to computer-generated hills and valleys through which a river flowed. In the distance, coming up fast, was a bridge on which was a simulated column of moving tanks and trucks. Paul Gray said, "Hold on." The horizon disappeared and turned to blue sky as the simulated jet climbed into the air. A radar screen in the cockpit now filled the right-hand viewing screen, and Gray said in a rapid tone of voice, "This is what the pilot would be paying close attention to at this point. See the radar image of the bridge? The computer has completely isolated it from the background clutter. See the crosshairs? Right on. Release. 1, 2, 3, 4. Now the screen in front of Khalil showed a close-up overhead view of the simulated bridge with the simulated armored column crossing it. 4 huge explosions, complete with deafening sound, erupted from the speakers as the bridge and the vehicles disintegrated into a fiery ball. The bridge began to collapse and a few vehicles fell off the structure. Then the simulation froze. Paul Gray said, "That's as much blood and guts as I wanted to program into the show. I don't want to be accused of loving this stuff." "But it must give you some enjoyment." Paul Gray did not reply. The screen went blank, and the room was dark. Both men sat in the darkness a while, then Gray said, "Most of the programs don't show such graphic detail. Most just give the pilot his bomb score and the results of the damage. In fact, Colonel, I don't enjoy war." "I didn't mean to be offensive." The lights brightened slightly, and Paul Gray turned his head toward his guest. He said, "May I see some sort of credentials?" "Of course. But let's first move to the virtual reality seats and destroy a real target with women and children. Perhaps, well, do you have, for instance, a Libyan target? Specifically, Al-Azizia?" Paul Gray stood and took a deep breath. "Who the hell are you?" Asad Khalil stood also, his plastic water bottle in one hand, his other hand in the pocket of his suit jacket. "I am, as God said to Moses, who I am. I am who I am." What a remarkable response to a stupid question. Who else could it have been but God? But I suppose Moses was nervous, not stupid. A nervous man says, "Who are you?" when what he really means is one of two things. I hope you are who I think you are, or I hope you are not who I think you are. So, who do you think I am, if not Colonel Itzhak Huruk of the Israeli embassy? Paul Gray did not reply. "I'll give you a hint. Look at me without my sunglasses. Picture me without the mustache. Who am I?" Paul Gray shook his head. "Don't pretend to be stupid, Captain. You know who I am." Again, Paul Gray shook his head, but this time took a step back from his visitor, focusing on Khalil's hand in his pocket. Asad Khalil said, "Our lives crossed once. On the 15th of April, in 1986, you were a lieutenant piloting an F-111 attack aircraft out of Lakenheath Air Base, call sign Elton 38. I was a boy of 16 who lived a pleasant life with my mother, 2 brothers, and 2 sisters in the place called Al-Azizia. They all died that night. So, that's who I am. Now, why do you think I am here?" Paul Gray cleared his throat and said, "If you are a military man, you understand war and you understand that orders must be obeyed. Shut up. I am not a military man, but I am an Islamic freedom fighter. In fact, it was you and your fellow murderers who made me what I am. And now I have arrived at your beautiful home to avenge the poor martyrs of Al-Azizia and all of Libya." Khalil pulled the pistol out of his pocket and pointed it at Paul Gray. Paul Gray's eyes darted around the room as though he were looking for an escape. Khalil said to him, "Look at me, Captain Paul Gray. Look at me. I am reality, not your stupid,
bloodless virtual reality. I am flesh and blood reality. I shoot back.
Paul Gray's eyes went back to Asad Khalil. Khalil said,
My name is Asad Khalil, and you can take that to hell with you.
Look, Mr. Khalil.
He stared at Khalil, and recognition dawned in his eyes.
Khalil said, Yes, I am that Asad Khalil who arrived on Flight 175, the man who your government is looking for. They should have looked here, or at the home of the late General Wycliffe and his late wife.
Oh, my God.
Or the home of Mr. Satherwaite, who I will visit next, or Mr. Wiggins, or Mr. McCoy, or Colonel Callum. But I'm happy to see that neither you nor they have reached any such conclusions.
How did you know?
All secrets are for sale. Your compatriots in Washington betrayed you all for money.
No.
No? Then perhaps it was the late Colonel Hambrecht, your squadron mate, who sold you to me.
No. Did you?
Yes, I killed him. With an axe. You will not suffer such physical pain as he did. Just mental pain. As you stand there and contemplate your sins and your punishment.
Paul Gray did not reply. Asad Khalil said,
Your knees are shaking, Captain. You can release your bladder if you wish. I won't be offended.
Paul Gray drew a deep breath and said,
Look, your information was wrong. I wasn't on that mission.
Oh. Then forgive me. I'll be leaving.
He smiled, then tipped his bottle of water and let it pour on the carpet. Paul Gray focused on the water splashing on the floor, then looked back at Asad Khalil and an expression of puzzlement crossed his face. Khalil had the Glock close to his body, the muzzle pushed into the neck of the plastic bottle. Paul Gray saw the bottom of the bottle pointing toward him, then saw that Khalil held the gun behind it, and he understood what that meant. He threw out his hands in a protective gesture.
No!
Khalil fired a single shot through the bottle, hitting Paul Gray in the abdomen. Gray doubled over and stumbled backwards until he sank to his knees. He grabbed his abdomen with both hands, trying to stem the flow of blood, then looked down and saw the blood seeping between his fingers. He looked up at Khalil, who was walking toward him.
Stop. No.
Khalil aimed the Glock with a contrived silencer and said,
I have no more time for you. You don't have the brains you were born with.
He fired a single shot into Paul Gray's forehead, blowing his brains out the back of his skull. Khalil turned before Paul Gray hit the floor and retrieved the two shell casings as he heard the body fall on the carpet. Khalil then went to an open safe sitting between two of the viewing screens. Inside, he found a stack of computer disks, which he put into his black bag, then extracted the disk from the computer that Paul Gray had been using. He said,
Thank you, Mr. Gray, for the demonstration. But war is not a video game in my country.
He looked around the room and found Paul Gray's appointment book on his desk. It was opened to that day, and the notation said, Colonel H, 9:30. He flipped to April 15 and read, Conference call, Squadron, A.M. He closed the appointment book and left it on the desk.
Let the police wonder who this Colonel H is, and let them think this mysterious colonel stole some military secrets from his victim.
Asad Khalil flipped through the Rolodex and extracted the cards for the remaining squadron members. Callum, McCoy, Satherwaite, and Wiggins. On each card were addresses, telephone numbers, and notations about wives and children. Khalil also took the card of General Terrence and Mrs. Gail Wycliffe, formerly of Washington, D.C., now residing in hell. He also found the card for Stephen Cox and saw that it was marked in red letters, KIA, which he knew to mean killed in action. There was on the card the name of a woman, Linda, and the notation, "Remarried Charles Dwyer," followed by an address and telephone number. The card for William Hambrecht had an address in England that was crossed out and replaced by an address in a place called Ann Arbor, Michigan, and the notation, "Deceased," followed by the date that Khalil had killed him. There was another woman's name, Rose, and the names of two more females and a male with the word "children." Asad Khalil put all the cards in his pocket, thinking he could make use of this information someday. He was pleased that Paul Gray was such a meticulous record keeper. Asad Khalil put his plastic bottle under his arm and held his pistol in his other hand. He slung his black bag over his shoulder and opened the sliding door. He could hear a vacuum cleaner running somewhere. He closed the door and followed the sound. He found the cleaning woman in the living room, her back to him, and she did not hear him as he stepped up behind her. The vacuum cleaner was very loud, and there was also music playing somewhere, so he didn't bother with the plastic bottle, but simply put the pistol close to the back of her neck as she pushed and pulled the vacuum cleaner. He now heard that she was singing as she worked. He pulled the trigger and she stumbled forward, then fell on the carpet beside the overturned vacuum cleaner. Khalil put the Glock in his pocket, placed the bottle in his bag, righted the vacuum cleaner but left it running, and recovered the shell casing. He found his way to the kitchen, then out the back door. He put on his sunglasses and retraced his route past the swimming pool, out of the screened enclosure, down the shrub-constricted path to the open area of the hangar. He noticed that the aircraft he'd arrived in was now pointing back to the taxiway. He did not see his pilot and went quickly to the hangar. He looked inside but did not see her there, then heard talking coming from the loft overhead. He went toward the staircase, then realized the talking was coming from a television or radio. He had forgotten the woman's name, so he called up, "Hello? Hello?" The talking stopped, and Stacy Maul leaned over the half wall of the loft and looked down. "All done?" "All done. Be right down." She disappeared, then reappeared on the staircase and came down to the hangar floor. She said, "Ready to roll?" "Yes, ready." She walked out of the hangar and he followed. She said, "You can eat off the floor in that hangar. This guy is an anal retentive. Maybe he's gay. You think he's gay?" "Excuse me?" "Never mind." She walked to the passenger side of the Piper and he followed. She asked, "Did he buy the vases?"
"Yes, he did."
"Great. Hey, I wanted to see them. You buy them all?"
"Yes, he did."
"Too bad. I mean, good for you. You get your prize?"
"I did."
"Great." She scrambled up on the wing and reached down for his bag, which Khalil handed her. She said, "Doesn't feel much lighter." "He gave me some bottles of water for the trip back." She opened the side door and put the bag in the rear and said, "I hope he gave you cash, too."
"Of course."
She got into the aircraft, then slid across to the left seat. Khalil followed her, sat in the right seat of the small cockpit, then buckled himself in. Even with the door still open, it was very hot in the cockpit, and Khalil felt sweat forming on his face. She started the engine, taxied off the apron, and turned right on the taxiway. She put the headset on and motioned for Khalil to do the same. He didn't want to listen to this woman any longer, but he did as she instructed. Her voice came through the earphones, and she said, "I took a Coke and put a buck in the fridge. You tell him?"
"I did."
"Protocol. You understand? Lots of protocol in the flying game. You can borrow what you need without asking, but you have to leave a note. You can take a beer or a Coke, but you have to leave a buck. What does this guy Gray do for a living?"
"Nothing."
"Where'd he get his money?"
"It is not my business to ask."
"Yeah. Me neither." They continued taxiing out to the airfield, and when they reached it, Stacy Maul glanced up at the windsock, then taxied to the end of runway 23. She then reached across Asad Khalil and closed and locked the door. She made a broadcast to other aircraft, visually checked the skies around her, then ran up the engine. She released the brake, and they rolled down the runway. The Piper lifted off, and at 500 feet, she began to turn to the north, back toward Craig Municipal Airport in Jacksonville. They stayed low for the first few minutes, then resumed a climb. The Piper settled into a cruise altitude of 3,500 feet at 140 knots. Stacy Mall said, "Flight time to Craig, 38 more minutes." Khalil didn't reply. They flew on in silence a while, then she asked, "Where are you headed after this?"
"I have an early afternoon flight to Washington, then back to Athens."
"You came all the way here just for this?"
"Yes."
"Geez, I hope it was worth it."
"It was."
"Maybe I should get into the Greek vase business."
"There is some risk involved."
"Yeah? Oh, like these vases aren't supposed to leave your country."
"It's best if you discussed this flight with no one. I have said too much already."
"Mum's the word."
"Excuse me?"
"My lips are sealed."
"Yes. Good. I will be back in a week. I would like to engage your services once again."
"No problem. Next time stay a while and we can have a drink."
"That would be pleasant."
They flew in silence for the next 10 minutes. Then she said, "Next time, just call from the airport and someone will pick you up. You don't have to take a taxi."
"Thank you.
In fact, if you want, I can drive you back to the airport."
"That's very kind of you."
"No problem." She said, "Just fax or call a day or two before you come and I'll be sure I'm available. Or make the reservation when we get back to the office."
"I will do that."
"Good. Here's my card."
She took a card out of her breast pocket and gave it to him. She made conversation with her passenger as they flew, and he made appropriate responses. As they began their descent, he asked her, "Did you make contact with your friend at Spruce Creek?"
"Well, I thought about calling him and telling him I was a couple of blocks away. But then I said to myself, screw him, he doesn't deserve a call. Someday, I'll fly in low and drop a live alligator in his pool." She laughed. "I know a guy who did that once to his ex-girlfriend, but the gator hit the roof and died on impact. Waste of a good gator." Khalil found himself smiling at this image. She noticed he was smiling and chuckled. "Good one, right?" They approached Craig Municipal Airport, and she radioed the tower for landing instructions. The tower cleared her for landing, and within 5 minutes they were lined up with the runway, and a few minutes later, they were on the ground. They taxied back to Alpha Aviation Services, and Stacy Mall cut the engine 50 feet from the office. Khalil retrieved his bag, and they both got out and began the walk to the building. She said, "Enjoy your flight?"
"Very much."
"Good. I don't always talk so much, but I enjoyed your company."
"Thank you.
You were a pleasant companion
and a very good pilot."
"Thanks." Before they reached the office, he said to her, "Would it be permissible if I asked you not to mention Spruce Creek?" She glanced at him and said, "Sure, no problem. Same price as Daytona Beach."
"Thank you."
They entered the office, and the woman at the desk stood and came to the counter. "Good flight?"
Khalil replied, "Yes, very good."
The woman examined some paperwork on a clipboard, then looked at her watch and made some notations. She said, "Okay, $350 should cover it." She counted out $150 and handed it to him. She said, "You can keep the $500 receipt for business." She winked conspiratorially. Khalil put the money in his pocket. Stacy Mall said, "I'm going to run Mr. Polos back to Jacksonville Airport unless you have something for me." "Nope. Sorry, honey." "That's okay. I'll take care of the Piper when I get back." The woman said to her customer, "Thank you for using Alpha. Call us again." Stacy asked Khalil, "You want to reserve for next week?"
"Yes. The same time, 1 week from today. The same destination, Daytona Beach."
The woman made a note on a piece of paper and said, "You got it." Khalil said,
"And I wish for this lady as the pilot."
The woman smiled and said, "You must be a glutton for punishment."
"Excuse me?"
"She can talk your ear off."
Okay, see you next week. She said to Stacy Mall, thanks for taking Mr. Polos back.
No problem.
Asad Khalil and Stacy Mall went out into the hot sunshine. She said, my car's over there. He followed her to a small convertible with the top up. She unlocked the doors with a remote control and asked him, top up or down?
The way it is.
Right. Stay here until I get it cooled off. She got inside, started the engine, and turned up the air conditioner. Waited a minute, then said, okay. He got in the passenger seat, and she said, buckle up. It's the law. He buckled his seatbelt. She closed her door, put the car in gear, and drove toward the exit. She asked, what time's your flight? 1 p.m. You're okay for time. She exited the airport and began accelerating. She said, I don't drive as good as I fly. A little slower, please.
Sure.
She eased off the gas. She asked, mind if I smoke?
Not at all.
She pushed the car lighter in, fingered a cigarette out of her pocket, and asked him, want one?
No, thank you.
These things are going to kill me. Perhaps. The lighter popped out, and she lit her cigarette. She said, there's a great Greek restaurant in Jacksonville. Spiro's. When you're in next week, maybe we can go there.
That would be nice. I'll arrange to stay overnight.
Yeah. What's the rush? Life is short.
Indeed. It is.
What's the name of that eggplant stuff? Moo something. Moulaka? What's it called?
I don't know.
She glanced at him. You know, it's a famous Greek dish. Moo. Moo something. Eggplant, fried in olive oil with goat cheese, you know?
He replied, there is much cooking from the provinces that I've never heard of. I am an Athenian.
Yeah? So is this guy who owns a restaurant.
Then I think perhaps he invents things for American tastes and invents a name for his creations.
She laughed. Wouldn't be surprised. That happened to me in Italy once. They never heard of what I wanted.
They were on a stretch of semi-rural highway, and Khalil said, I am embarrassed to say that I should have used the lavatory at your office.
Huh? Oh, you gotta take a leak? Oh, no problem. Gas station up the road.
Perhaps here, if you don't mind. There is some urgency.
Gotcha.
She pulled off onto a farm road and stopped the car. She said, take care of business. I won't peek. Thank you.
He got out of the car, walked a few feet toward a clump of bushes, and urinated. He put his right hand in his pocket and walked back toward the car and stood at the open door. She said, feel better?
He didn't reply.
Jump in.
Again, he didn't reply.
You okay? Demetrius?
He took a long breath and noticed that his heart was pounding.
She got out of the car quickly, came around, and took his arm. Hey, you okay?
He looked at her and said,
Yes.
I am fine.
You want some water? You got that water in your bag?
He drew a long breath and said, no, I am fine.
He forced a smile and said,
ready to roll.
She smiled back at him and said, good, let's roll.
They both got in the car and she turned back onto the main road.
Asad Khalil sat in silence, trying to comprehend why he hadn't killed her. He satisfied himself with the explanation that, as Malik said, each killing entails a risk, and perhaps this killing was not necessary. There was another reason he hadn't killed her, but he did not want to think about what it was.
They got to Jacksonville International Airport, and she pulled up to the international departure area.
Here we are.
Thank you. He asked, is it appropriate that I give you a tip?
No. Buy me dinner.
Yes. Next week. He opened the door and got out. She said, have a good flight home.
See you next week.
Yes. He took the black bag from the car, started to close the door, then said, I enjoyed our conversation.
You mean my monologue?
She laughed. See you later, alligator.
Excuse me?
You say, after a while, crocodile.
I say,
she laughed.
Remember, dinner at Spiro's. I want you to order in Greek.
Yes. Have a good day. He closed the door.
She lowered the window and said, Moussaka.
Excuse me?
The Greek dish, moussaka.
Yes, of course. She waved and sped off. He watched her car until it was out of sight, then went to a line of taxis and took the first one. The driver said, Where to?
Craig Municipal Airport.
You got it.
The taxi drove him back to Craig Municipal Airport, and Khalil directed him to a car rental agency close to his parked Mercury. He paid the driver, waited until he was gone, then walked to his car. He got in, started the engine, and opened the windows. Asad Khalil drove out of the municipal airport, programming his satellite navigator for Monk's Corner, South Carolina. He said to himself, Now I will pay a long overdue visit to Lieutenant William Satherwaite, who is expecting me, but not expecting to die today.
Chapter 38. By mid-afternoon Monday, I had moved my stuff to the Incident Command Center along with about 40 other men and women. The ICC is set up in this big commo room, which reminded me of the room in the Conquistador Club. There was a real buzz in the place, like everyone was on uppers, and the phones were ringing, faxes were going off, computer terminals were all lit up, and so forth. I'm not exactly familiar with a lot of the new technology, and my idea of high tech is a flashlight and a phone, but my brain works just fine. Anyway, Kate and I had desks that faced each other in a small, chest-high cubicle, which was kind of neat, I guess, but a little awkward. So I was all settled in, and I was reading a huge stack of memos and interrogation reports, plus some of the crap I'd picked up in D.C. the day before. This is not my idea of working a case, but there wasn't much else I could do at the moment. I mean, in a regular homicide case, I'd be out on the street or down at the morgue or bugging the medical examiner or the forensic people, and generally making life miserable for a lot of people so that my life could be better. Kate looked up from a desk and said to me, Did you see this memo about funerals?
No, I didn't.
She glanced at a memo in her hand and read me the arrangements. Nick Monty was being waked at a funeral home in Queens, and his full inspector's funeral would be on Tuesday. Phil Hundry and Peter Gorman were being shipped back to their hometowns out of state. Meg Collins, the duty officer, was to be waked in New Jersey and buried on Wednesday. The arrangements for Andy McGill and Nancy Tate were to be announced, and I guess that the medical examiner had held things up. I've been at nearly every wake, burial, and memorial service of everyone I've ever worked with, and never missed one where the person was killed on the line of duty. But I didn't have time for the dead just now, and I said to Kate, I'll skip the wakes and burials. She nodded, but said nothing. We kept at the reading, answered a few phone calls, and read some faxes. I managed to access my email, but other than something called the Monday Funnies, there wasn't much interesting. We drank coffee, swapped ideas and theories with the people around us, and generally spun our wheels, waiting for something. As new people arrived in the room, they glanced at Kate and me. We were sort of minor celebrities, I guess, being the only two people in the room who had been eyewitnesses to the biggest mass murder in American history. Living eyewitnesses, I should say. Jack Koenig entered the room and came over to us. He sat so that he was below the cubicle partition and said, I just got a top-secret communique from Langley. At 6:13 p.m. German time, a man answering the description of Asad Khalil shot to death an American banker in Frankfurt. The gunman escaped. But the four eyewitnesses described the gunman as Arab-looking, so the German police showed them Khalil's photo, and they all ID'd him. I was, to say the least, stunned. Crushed. I saw my whole career down the toilet. I miscalculated, and when you do that, you have to wonder if you've totally lost whatever it was that you had. I glanced at Kate and saw that she, too, was shocked. She really had believed that Khalil was still in the U.S. My mind raced ahead to my resignation and badly attended retirement party. This was a bad end to things. You don't recover professionally from blowing the biggest case in the world. I stood and said to Jack, "Well, that's it. I guess, I mean," for the first time in my life, I felt like a loser, like a totally incompetent blowhard, an idiot, and a fool. Jack said softly, "Sit down." "No, I'm out of here. Sorry, guys." I grabbed my jacket and went out into the long corridor, my mind not working and my body just sort of moving like an out-of-body experience, like when I was bleeding to death in the ambulance. I didn't even recall getting to the elevator, but there I was, waiting for the doors to open. To make matters worse, I'd lost a total of $30 to the CIA. All of a sudden, Kate and Jack were beside me. Jack said, "Listen, you're not going to breathe a word of this to anyone." I couldn't understand what he was saying. Jack Koenig went on, "The ID is not positive. How can it be? Right? So we need everyone to keep working this case as if Khalil may still be here. Understand? Only a handful of people know about this Frankfurt thing. I thought I owed it to you to tell you, but not even Stein knows about this. John, you have to keep this to yourself." I nodded. "And you can't do anything to arouse suspicion. In other words, you can't resign." "Yes, I can." Kate said, "John, you can't do that. You've got to do this one last thing. You have to carry on as if nothing has happened." "I can't. I'm not good at play acting. And what's the point?" Jack said, "The point is not to ruin everyone's morale and enthusiasm. Look, we don't know if this guy in Frankfurt really was Khalil." He tried to make a joke and said, "Why would Dracula go to Germany?" I didn't want to be reminded of my stupid Dracula analogy, but I tried to clear my head and think rationally. Finally, I said, "Maybe it was a plant, a lookalike." Koenig nodded. "That's right. We don't know." The elevator came, the doors opened, but I didn't get in. In fact, I realized Kate was holding my arm. Koenig said, "I'm offering you two the opportunity to fly to Frankfurt tonight and join the American team there, FBI, CIA, and German police, and German intelligence people. I think you should go." He added, "I will accompany you for a day or two." I didn't reply. Finally, Kate said, "I think we should go. John?" "Yeah, I guess better than being here." Koenig looked at his watch and said, "There's an 8:10 p.m. Lufthansa out of JFK to Frankfurt. Arrives tomorrow morning. Ted will meet us at Nash." "Nash is there? I thought he was in Paris." "I guess he was, but he's on his way to Frankfurt now." I nodded. Something smelled funny. Koenig said, "Okay, let's wrap it up here and be at JFK no later than 7 p.m. Lufthansa, 8:10 flight to Frankfurt. Tickets will be waiting for us. Pack for a long stay." He turned and walked back to the ICC. Kate stood there a while and said, "John, what I like about you is your optimism. You don't let anything get you down. You see problems as a challenge, not as a..." "I don't need a pep talk." "Okay." We both walked toward the ICC. Kate said, "That's very good of Jack to send us to Frankfurt. Have you been to Frankfurt?"
"No."
"I've been a few times." She added, "This trip could take us all over Europe following leads. Can you break away on short notice without too much inconvenience?" There seemed to be other questions hidden in that question, but I replied simply, "No problem." We got to the ICC and we went to our desks. I packed some papers in my attaché case and threw junk in my desk drawers. I wanted to call Beth Penrose, but I thought it might be better if I waited until I got home. Kate finished up at her desk and said, "I'm going to go home and pack. You leaving now?"
"No.
I can pack in 5 minutes. I'll meet you at JFK. See you later." She took a few steps, then came back and put her face close to mine. She said, If Khalil is here, you were right. If he's in Europe, he'll be there. Okay? I noticed a few people looking at us. I said to her, thanks. She left. I sat at my desk and contemplated this turn of events, trying to identify the smell in my nostrils. Even if Khalil had left the country, why and how had he gotten to Europe? Even a guy like that would head home for a pat on the back. And clipping a banker was not exactly a strong second act after what he'd done here. And yet, I was really burning up the neurons on this one. It's easy to outfox yourself when you're too smart for your own good. I mean, the brain is a remarkable thing. It is the only cognitive organ in the human body except for a man's penis. So I sat there and put my brain in overdrive. My other controlling organ was saying, go to Europe with Kate and get laid. There's nothing in New York for you, John. But the higher areas of my intellect were saying, someone's trying to get rid of you. Now, I don't necessarily mean someone was trying to get me overseas to have me whacked, but maybe someone was trying to get me away from where the action was. Maybe this Khalil thing in Frankfurt was made up either by the Libyans or by the CIA. It really sucks when you don't know what's real and what's made up, who your friends are and who your enemies are. Like Ted Nash. Sometimes I envy people with diminished mental capacity. Like my Uncle Bertie, who's senile. He can hide his own Easter eggs, you know? But I wasn't where Uncle Bertie was yet. I had too many synapses opening and closing, and the wiring was burning up with information, theories, possibilities, and suspicions. I stood to leave, then sat down again, then stood again. This looked weird, so I moved toward the door with my briefcase, determined to make my decision before I left for the airport. I was leaning toward Frankfurt at that moment. I got to the elevators, and coming toward me was Gabriel Haytham. He saw me and motioned me toward him. I went to where he was standing, and he said in a soft voice, I think I have a live one for you. Meaning? I got a guy in an interrogation room. This guy's a Libyan, and he made contact with one of our stakeout teams. You mean he's a volunteer? Yeah, just like that. He has no prior problems with us, no history as an informant. He's not on any list or anything. Regular Yusuf, whose name is Fadi Aswad. Why do all your names sound like the starting lineup of the Knicks? Gabriel laughed. Hey, try the Chinatown Task Force. Their names sound like the noise a pinball machine makes. Look, this guy Aswad is a taxi driver, and this guy has a brother-in-law, another Libyan, named Gamal Jabbar. Jabbar drives a taxi, too. We Arabs all drive taxis, right? Right. So, early Saturday morning, Gamal Jabbar calls his brother-in-law, Fadi Aswad, and tells him that he's going to be gone for the whole day, that he has a special fare he has to pick up at JFK, and that he's not happy about this fare. I'm listening. Gamal also says that if he's late getting home, that Fadi should call his wife, who's Fadi's sister, and reassure her that everything is okay. And? Well, you have to understand the Arabs. I'm trying. What Gamal was saying to his brother-in-law, but yeah, I get it. Like, I may be more than a little late. Right. Like I may be dead. I asked, so where's Gamal? Dead. But Fadi doesn't know that. I just got off the horn with homicide. Perth Amboy cops got a call this morning from an early commuter who went to some park and ride about 6:30 a.m. sunrise, and he sees his yellow cab with New York plates. He thinks this is strange, and as he's walking to the bus shelter, he peeks inside and sees a guy half on the floor on the driver's side. Doors are locked. He gets on his cell phone and calls 911. I said, let's go talk to Fadi. Right. But I think I squeezed him dry. In Arabic. Let me try English. We walked down the corridor, and I said to Gabe, why'd you come to me with this? Why not? You need some points. He added, fuck the FBI. Amen. We stopped in front of the door of an interrogation room. Gabe said, I got a preliminary forensic report over the phone. This guy Gamal was killed with a single bullet that was fired through the back of his seat, which severed his spinal column and nicked his right ventricle, exiting into the dashboard. .40 caliber? Right. Bullet is deformed, but definitely a .40. The guy's been dead since about Saturday, late afternoon, early evening.
Did anyone check his EZ pass?
Yeah, but there's no toll records on his account for Saturday. Kamal lived in Brooklyn, apparently went to JFK and wound up in New Jersey. You can't get there without paying a toll, so he paid cash, and maybe his passenger was sitting behind a newspaper or something. We won't be able to trace his route, but the mileage on his meter checks out for a trip from JFK to where we found him and his taxi. We don't have a positive ID on the guy yet, but his hack license looks like the deceased.
Anything else?
That's all the important stuff.
I opened the door and we entered a small interrogation room. Sitting at a table was Fadi Aswan, dressed in jeans, running shoes, and a green sweatshirt. He was puffing on a cigarette, the ashtray was overflowing, and the room was thick with smoke. This is a federally correct no-smoking building, of course, but if you're a suspect or a witness to a major crime, you may smoke.
There was another ATTF NYPD guy in the room watching the witness for signs that he might kill himself more quickly than by smoking, and making sure he didn't stroll away, down the elevator and out, as happened once. Fadi stood as soon as he saw Gabriel Haytham, and I liked that. I have to get my witnesses and suspects to stand when I enter a room. Anyway, the ATTF guy left, and Gabriel introduced me to my star witness.
Fadi, this is Colonel John.
Jesus, I must have done really well on the sergeant's exam.
Fadi sort of bowed his head, but said nothing. I invited us all to sit, and we sat. I put my briefcase on the table so Fadi could see it. Third world types equate briefcases with power for some reason. Fadi was a voluntary witness and thus had to be treated well. His nose appeared unbroken and there were no visible contusions on his face. Just kidding. But I knew that Gabe could be rough at times. Gabe took Fadi's cigarette pack and offered me one. I noticed that the cigarettes were Camels, which I found funny for some reason. You know, Camels, Arabs. Anyway, I took a cigarette and so did Gabe. We lit up with Fadi's lighter, but I didn't inhale. Honest, I did not inhale. There was a tape recorder on the table, and Gabe hit the button, then said to Fadi, "Tell the colonel what you told me." Fadi looked anxious to please, but he also looked scared shitless. I mean, you almost never get an Arab walk-in unless they're trying to fuck someone else, or if there's a reward to be had, or if they were agents, provocateurs, to use a French and CIA term. In any case, the guy who he was telling us about, Kamal Jabbar, was dead, so part of this guy's story checked out already, though he didn't know it yet. Anyway, Fadi's English was okay, but he lost me a few times. Now and then he'd slip into Arabic, then turn to Gabe, who translated. Finally, he finished his story and chain-lit another cigarette. We sat there for a full minute, and I let him sweat a little. I mean, he really was sweating. I leaned toward him and asked slowly, "Why are you telling us this?" He took a deep breath and sucked about half the smoke in the room into his lungs. He replied, "I am worried about my sister's husband." "Has Gamal ever disappeared before?"
"No, he is not that type."
I continued the interrogation, alternating hard and soft questions. I tend to be blunt during interrogations. It saves time and keeps the witness or suspect off balance. But I knew from my brief training and experience with Mideast types that they are masters at beating around the bush, talking in circumlocution, answering a question with a question, engaging in seemingly endless theoretical discussions and so forth. Maybe that's why the police in some of their countries beat the shit out of them. But I played the game, and we had a nice, non-productive half hour of chit-chat, both of us wondering what in the world could have happened to Kamal Jabbar. Gabe seemed to appreciate my cultural sensitivity, but even he was getting a little impatient. The bottom line here was that we had a lead, a break, really. You actually know that something is going to pop up, but you're always surprised when it actually does. I strongly suspected that Kamal Jabbar picked up Asad Khalil at JFK, took him to the park and ride at Perth Amboy, New Jersey, then got a slug in his back for his trouble. My main questions were, where did Khalil go next, and how did he get there? I said to Fadi Aswad, "Are you certain that Gamal didn't say to you that he was picking up a fellow Libyan?"
"Well, sir, he did not say that, but it is possible. I say this because I do not think my brother-in-law would accept such a special fare from, let us say, a Palestinian or an Iraqi.
My brother-in-law, sir, was a Libyan patriot, but he was not much involved in the politics of other countries who share our faith in Allah. May peace be unto him. So, sir, if you are asking me if his special passenger was someone other than a Libyan, or if, in fact, he was a Libyan, in either case, I could not be certain. But then I must ask myself, why would he go to such lengths to accommodate a man who was not a Libyan? Do you see my point, sir?
Holy shit. My head was spinning and my eyes were rolling. I couldn't even remember the fucking question. I looked at my watch. I could still catch the flight. But why should I? I asked Fadi, and Gamal did not say where his destination was to be.
No, sir.
I was a little thrown off by the short form answer. I asked, he didn't mention Newark Airport?
No, sir, he did not.
I leaned toward Fadi and said, look, you didn't contact the ATT after report of missing brother-in-law. You obviously know who we are and what we do, and this isn't family court, my friend. Capiche?
Sir?
Here's a direct question, and I want a one-word answer. Do you think your brother-in-law's disappearance has anything to do with what happened with the transcontinental flight at Kennedy Airport Saturday? Yes or no?
Well, sir, I have been thinking about this possibility.
Yes or no?
He lowered his eyes and said, yes.
You understand that your brother-in-law, your sister's husband, may have met with a misfortune?
He nodded.
You know that he thought he might be killed?
Yes.
Is it possible he left any other clue, any other...
I looked at Gabe, who asked the question in Arabic.
Fadi replied in Arabic, and Gabe translated.
Gamal said to Fadi that Fadi should look after his family if something happened to him. Gamal said to Fadi that he had no choice but to take the special fare, and that Allah in his mercy would see him safely home.
No one spoke for a while. I could see that Fadi was visibly upset. I used the time to think about this. In one way, we had nothing of any immediate use. We just had Khalil's movements from JFK to Perth Amboy, if indeed it was Khalil who was in Gamal's taxi. And if it was, all we knew for sure was that Khalil had probably murdered Gamal and then left Gamal's taxi and disappeared. But where did he disappear to? To Newark Airport? How did he get there? Another taxi? Or was there an accomplice with a private car waiting for him at the park and ride? Or maybe a rental car? And which direction did he go? In any case, he'd slipped through the net and was no longer in the New York metro area. I looked at Fadi Aswad and asked him, does anyone know you contacted us? He shook his head. Not even your wife? He looked at me like I was nuts. He said, I do not speak to my wife of such things. Why would you tell a woman or a child of such things?
Good point.
I stood. Okay, Fadi, you did the right thing by coming to us. Uncle Sam loves you. Go back to work and act like nothing has happened, okay? He nodded. Also, I've got some bad news for you. Your brother-in-law has been murdered. He stood and tried to speak, then looked at Gabe, who spoke to him in Arabic. Fadi slumped into his chair and buried his face in his hands. I said to Gabe, tell him not to say anything when the homicide guys come around. Give him your card and tell him to show that to the detectives and have them call ATTF. Gabe nodded and spoke to Fadi in Arabic, then gave him his card. It occurred to me that I once had been a homicide cop, but here I was telling a witness not to talk to NYPD homicide and to call the feds instead. The transformation was nearly complete. Scary. I took my briefcase, Gabe and I left the room, and the ATTF guy went in. Fadi's statement would be reduced to writing, and he would sign it before he had left. Out in the corridor, I said, keep a 24-hour stakeout on him, his family, and his sister, and so forth.
Done. Make sure no one sees him leaving this building.
We always do.
Right.
And send a few guys over to 1PP and see if there are any more dead cabbies around.
I already asked. They're checking.
Good.
Am I insulting your intelligence?
Just a little.
I smiled for the first time that day. I said to Gabe, thanks for this. I owe you one.
Right.
So, what do you think?
I think what I always thought. Khalil is in America and he's not hiding out. He's on the move. He's on a mission.
That's what I think. What's the mission?
Beats me, Gabe.
Think about it.
Hey, are you a Libyan?
No, there aren't many Libyans here. It's a small country with a small immigrant community in the U.S.
He added, I'm actually Palestinian.
Against my better judgment, I asked him, don't you find this a little awkward? Stressful?
He shrugged.
It's okay most of the time. I'm an American, second generation. My daughter wears shorts and makeup, talks back to me, and pals around with Jews.
I smiled and looked at him. I asked, you ever get any threats from anyone?
Now and then. But they know it's not a good idea to whack a cop who's cross-designated as a federal officer.
I would have